From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about that weird mix in human nature of virtue and violence. Our guest is the acclaimed anthropologist Richard Wrangham, who for years has been puzzling over the question, how is it humans can be peaceful at times but also so violent? His new book explores how we evolved both tendencies. It's called The Goodness Paradox. We'll be right back.
KUER's community calendar is a resource where you can find hundreds of events happening across Utah. You can learn a new skill in workshops, experience art and performances offered across the state, scout family-friendly events and activities, and a whole lot more. You can also share your own events. Just fill out the form. It's all on our website, KUER.org. Just click Community Calendar under the Events tab.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We'll talk about this a little bit later on the program, but the anthropologist Richard Wrangham says there are usually two explanations for human nature. One is that we're inherently good. We're peaceful, we're cooperative, we're good, and that because of environmental and societal forces, we become not so good. We get violent and petty. The other explanation has it that we are born bad. This is our natural state, and over time we can learn to overcome our nature and to act civilized. Wrangham says, what if both things were true? What if we are both innately good and innately bad? That's the argument he makes in his new book. He says in it, the combination that makes humans odd is that we can be both intensely calm in our normal social interactions and in some circumstances, we can become so aggressive we will kill. The book is about how it is this came to be. What is it that happened during our evolution that accounts for this goodness paradox? That's the title of the book, and Richard Wrangham is joining us to talk about it. Wrangham is the Ruth B. Moore Professor of Biological Anthropology at Harvard University. He's the author of a number of books, among them Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. This new book, as I said, is The Goodness Paradox, The Strange Relationship Between Virtue and Violence in Human Evolution. Wrangham joined us from a studio on the Harvard campus. So I wanted to begin here. You mentioned early in the book that when you began your career, that you say you would have been surprised to see your focus shifted eventually to humans because, of course, you began working with Jane Goodall and your focus was chimpanzees and that was an absolute joy for you. But then something happened, something changed where you switched. Talk about that first, if you would.
Well, I think for me, the first dramatic incident was that in 1973, I personally came across the body of a chimpanzee that appeared to have been killed by other chimpanzees, and that got me thinking. And then in 1974, about 6 months later, when I was gone from Jane Goodall's site where I'd been working, other people directly witnessed an attack by the habituated group of chimpanzees on a stranger not to the humans, but someone who was no longer in the same group as the attackers. And they hunted this victim down and killed him. Yeah. And that began a series of incidents that really resembled very closely simple patterns of human warfare. And so, you know, I got into this whole business by just loving natural history. I was a bird watcher, and then I got the opportunity to watch mammals. I was fascinated by differences in social organization among species. But what chimpanzees do is present you with something that is, in a way, intermediate between other animals and humans. And in particular, this haunting discovery of a deliberate attack on members of neighboring groups leading to a kill is something that is completely unusual in other animals. And here it was turning up in our close relatives. And that, of course, raised huge questions about the implications for understanding human nature.
One of the things you've mentioned is that often scholars have engaged in this kind of sterile argument that it's a paradoxical combination we have as humans of selfishness and selflessness. And so where we've come down are these kind of two classical explanations for the paradox, like you have to pick a side. Talk a little bit about those two different – you're saying we don't have to pick a side, but what are the two explanations for human nature?
Yeah, it's such a fascinating problem because humans are such a weird species compared to other animals because on the one hand, we have the patterns of violence that I just mentioned where humans do actually kill other members of our own species at rates that are almost higher than any other species. They're not quite higher than any other. They're not quite as high as wolves. But nevertheless, it's a very extreme in that direction. And so on the one hand, we appear to be an incredibly violent species. On the other hand, we all know that in daily life, our interactions with each other are tolerant and pleasant and very unlikely to lead to aggression, particularly they're not likely to lead to a fight. And if you compare us with other animals, we are exceptionally non-aggressive in that respect. So how can we be both these things at once? How can we be exceptionally aggressive and exceptionally non-aggressive? And the classical solution has gone in one of two directions. You know, some people say, well, of course, we're instinctively violent, and what we need is society to be able to find a way to control that violence. Or people say, well, we're instinctively very delightful, and the problem is that we get corrupted by society. And that's the fight that is represented by Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Thomas Hobbes. It goes back to two or 300 years ago, and that is the fight that I think we can now, for the first time, really see a solution to.
Well, you're arguing in the book that we don't have to pick a side. In fact, you say we're both of these things, and you say really what we should be asking ourselves is whether the debate makes sense at all. Explain that.
Well, the old terms of the debate are they kind of assume that the way to think about a propensity for aggressiveness is that there's all one single scale of aggressiveness, and we're either low on it by nature or high on it by nature. And the new way to think about it, which comes out of work in biology and psychology, is to say, well, wait a minute. There isn't just one type of aggressiveness. There are probably multiple, but the really important division is between two types. One is called reactive aggression, which is the emotional type where you flare up when somebody insults you and you likely get into a fight, which means that you will personally get hurt. And the other is proactive aggression, which is the cold, premeditated, planned kind of aggression that seeks to get a particular kind of goal and is only undertaken if you have a pretty confident feeling that you're not going to get hurt in doing it. And the sort of short answer to the old debate is that the way to think about humans is that we are very low on our propensity for reactive aggression compared to other animals, but we're rather high on our propensity for proactive aggression compared to other species.
And this is what you've spent two decades trying to sort of figure out, I suppose, is how we evolved to those two capacities, I suppose.
Yes, because, I mean, it's so fascinating. You know, most animals seem to be high on both or low on both.
Yeah.
But you do get examples, and partly from experiments in captivity, where the two types can be separated. And that makes sense because if we look at the neurobiology, it turns out that the two types can be separated. You know, they work in different parts of the brain to some extent. And so here are humans where we've got this great division. Were we a species that had very low propensity for reactive aggression and proactive aggression, and then we became killers? Or were we high in both, and then we became astonishingly docile in some ways? Mm.
What can we learn? There are two animal groups that I wanted to ask you about that you've explored. Bonobos, on one hand, and of course chimpanzees, as you mentioned. You say one of the central questions in the book is why is it humans are partly like bonobos and partly like chimpanzees. What can the study of those two animal, different animal groups tell us about human beings at this point, do you think?
Well, they're a very astonishing pair. Chimpanzees and bonobos are our two closest relatives. They are both apes living in Africa. They don't live in the same area as each other. They live either side of the great Congo River, which winds across the equator. Chimps to the north and bonobos to the south. They look very much like each other. If you go to a zoo, you have to be a bit of an expert to be able to recognize which one is which. And yet, even though they're the same size and they live in very similar habitats and they look like each other and they eat the same sorts of things in the wild, nevertheless, their psychology is really extraordinarily different. And in many ways, the chimpanzee represents a more violent species. They often have episodes of fighting within their groups, fighting where it's the equivalent of losing your temper. And they also, as I mentioned earlier, make deliberate attempts to go off and kill members of neighboring groups. So they are high on proactive and reactive aggression. And then you get the bonobo. Right. And when people first started studying them, I think they probably expected to see behaviors very much like you see in chimps. Mm. And it turned out to be remarkably different because they have a very much reduced tendency for aggression of both types. They show, so far as we know, no clear cases of proactive aggression at all. I expect occasionally they'll show something, but so far it hasn't been described. And their reactive aggression, they often do get into small fights, but they don't press them home. They sort of give up very quickly on the whole. So they're much, it's a much nicer life among bonobos. You know, people are often drawn to the fact that they also have all sorts of other peculiarities, like very extended diversity of sexual behavior. But to me, the really important thing is that their aggression levels are much reduced. So what is it about these two species that can help us? And of course, it's not that we evolved directly from either of them, and it's not that because one of them has a certain type of behavior that means that humans have the same type, but they give us models for understanding the way evolution works.
Right.
And what the first thing they show is that it is perfectly possible to have a great diversity of sort of psychology in the wild, despite remarkable similarities in their ways of life. Then, of course, the question is, why?
I want to get to this question that you delve into of what it means to be domesticated. One of the arguments you make is that, and we'll sort of work through this as we go, is that that you and your colleagues believe that in some ways human beings have come to this point of self-domestication. And so let's talk about what that means exactly, first of all. You mentioned how tolerance, for example, is rare in wild animals, but in domesticated species you do find it. So talk about what you mean by domestication before we get to the idea of self-domestication.
Domestication is, for most people, such as me, typically associated with, of course, animals that actually live in the human orbit, the dogs and cats and goats and horses that live in the farmyard or in our homes. And the word domestication comes from the word for home, yeah. Domus. The way in which I've used it in this book is very slightly different because the domestication, the feature of domestication that seems to be absolutely uniform in all of those domesticated animals is a reduction in the propensity for reactive aggression. Mm. We wouldn't want to live with these animals if they behaved like they do in the wild because it would just be too dangerous. You can't have wolves running around inside your house. You can't even have wild bulls running around in your field. There would be too much chaos. And so inadvertently or deliberately, farmers in the past have domesticated these species, meaning that the ones that have ended up breeding and being kept successfully by humans are the ones that were relatively unaggressive. Well, I've taken that word domestication actually to mean a reduction in reactive aggression because that is such an important feature of it and because there is no other sort of convenient word for it. And then, so that's the animals that are familiar to us because they've grown up with us and they've been domesticated from wild ancestors. But once you start recognizing that the key feature of domestication is this loss of aggressiveness, well, then you say to yourself, well, let's think about wild animals. I mean, in the wild, some species have evolved from ancestors that were less aggressive than themselves, so they've become more aggressive. But others have evolved from species that were more aggressive than themselves, and they've become less aggressive. And in that case, I want to apply the term self-domestication to connote the fact that they went through a period of evolving a reduced propensity for reactive aggression, being more tolerant with other members of their own species, as a consequence of some evolutionary process, a selective mechanism, that happened quite independently of humans.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, very importantly and fascinatingly, producing some of the same features other than aggression that you get in domesticated animals.
You write in the book that the idea of human self-domestication goes back a long way, back to the ancient Greeks. Now, we'll talk about the actual biological process of self-domestication, but what did the ancient Greeks mean by that term?
Well, Aristotle and then his former pupil Theophrastus, they are celebrated for having tried to think about where humans fit into the natural world and saying, well, you know, the funny thing about humans is that we're so unaggressive, we're like a domesticated animal. So that, you know, they were the first people on record that I know of to make that comparison. And one of the interesting questions was whether that really applied to the whole species, as Theophrastus said, or just to Greeks and Greek friends, as Aristotle said. And he, of course, was wrong about that. But either way, the notion is that let's think about humans not just as, you know, the special species that everyone has always thought them to be, but as a species fitting into the natural world and comparable to others. And what is interesting about us? And it was that lack of aggression that they pointed to.
It seems like, though, this now may be the first time that this idea of self-domestication is being seen and expressed in a biological way that we can actually see, as you put in the book, and this is an important part of the story, anatomical changes related to self-domestication. Talk a little bit about this part, that we can actually see physical transformations related to all of this.
Well, this is such an important starting point, you know, because, as you say, for many years, people have thought of humans as being like a domesticated animal from the point of view of behavior.
Yeah.
But then in 2003, the archaeologist Helen Leach from New Zealand, she pointed out that humans are like a domesticated animal in terms of our bones as well. So what she drew attention to was the fact that the characteristics of the species of Homo that is ours, namely Homo sapiens, that goes back 200,000 years very fully, or 300,000 years in its origins, the characteristics that make us human are characteristics that look like those that occur in domesticated animals compared to their wild ancestors. Mm-hmm. And what these are, there are four in particular, but there are others as well. The short face, our face is a little less protruding than it was in our ancestors prior to 300,000 years ago. Smaller teeth, particularly the chewing, the molar teeth. A reduced degree of difference between the male and the female skulls, and in a particular direction, which is that the males are now looking more like females. So it's a feminization process. Homo sapiens looks less masculine and less sort of horridly male than those huge, great, wide faces of our mid-Pleistocene ancestors. And then finally, this is a rather controversial one from the point of view of human evolution, but the last one is a reduction in the size of the brain. Yeah. And of course, that's very surprising in terms of humans, because the big story about humans is that during the last 2 million years, our ancestors have had an unparalleled rise in the size of the brain. But it is the case that in the last 30,000 years, the brains of humans have been reduced in size. And then the question is, does that fit into the typical pattern for domesticated animals, where very uniformly you have a reduction in brain size? Or is it simply because there was a reduction in body size and the brain got smaller because the bodies got smaller? And that's a somewhat unresolved debate.
Yeah. It helped me understand it when you said it's. If you want to get a sense of the difference, look at a dog and then look at a wolf. That helped me understand it, just to get a sense of which was domestic and which wasn't.
Yes. I mean, one of the features that is in many ways rather charming, I think, about domesticated animals is that a number of them show a tendency for the juvenile characteristics of the wild ancestor to be retained into the adult of the domestic descendant. So this process of retention of juvenile traits is called pedomorphism, or sometimes neoteny, depending on exactly how it works. And it's charming because what it means is that the adult of the descendant looks cute because it looks more like a juvenile. And so the shorter face and a rounder forehead of dogs compared to wolves looks cute to us because it looks more like a juvenile wolf. And to some extent, that is what's happened also in the human skull compared to the skulls of Neanderthals.
So the question is, one of the big questions here, of course, is how is it that humans, how did we start to self-domesticate? And one of the ways seems to be to language, or as you describe it, this language-based conspiracy. Talk about how language starts to contribute to all of this.
To me, the clue for all this is to go to small-scale societies nowadays where there are no mechanisms provided by the state to be able to control individuals who are excessively aggressive. And so, you know, the question I'd like to ask is, how is it nowadays that an individual who throws his weight around, who uses his aggression to bully and dominate and take what he wants, what is it that stops him from being an evolutionary success? Yeah. Because you might think that if he rapes at will, if he takes food from other people whenever he wants it, he would be a success. Well, it wasn't obvious until relatively recently what the answer was to this. It was known that in small-scale societies, such as hunters and gatherers and people living in small farming villages, that there was a big effort to try and persuade people not to throw their weight around, not to be bullies and tyrants and so on. So they would cajole them, and maybe they would ridicule them, maybe they would ostracize them, and very often that would work. But then the social anthropologist Christopher Boehm did a really serious review of many, many different descriptions of people in these societies. And what he realized is that enough times, that simply doesn't work. Yeah. And then something else has to come into play. And what that something else is ultimately capital punishment. Yeah. It is that individuals in the society, they get together and they make an agreement. And the agreement leads to a decision to kill this appalling man who is throwing his weight around in such an unpleasant way. And the significant thing about this is that because they can plan it and use their proactive aggression, then the killers don't get hurt. They may not be able to carry out their action very quickly. It may take them weeks before they get to the point where they can get the man away from his weapons or fire at his back or whatever it is in a way that means that it's totally safe for them. But nevertheless, eventually they do that. Well, so the question is, what is it that enables humans to do this? Because no other species does this. No other species shows proactive aggression to kill members of its own group. And of course, you know, if you look at the way it happens in these societies, it's very clear that it only can happen because in these very claustrophobic environment, people are very gentle about slowly working up the idea of, are you on my side? Yeah. Do you agree with me? Does the guy really deserve it? Shall we do it? You need quite sophisticated language to be able to do this.
It's so interesting because in bonobo society, which of course doesn't have language in the way humans does, reactive aggression, you mentioned, is kept in check by, in that case, females getting together to punish bullying and violence. They don't have to resort to capital punishment. Human society had to. What's the essential difference there as you understand it?
Yeah, it's very intriguing because, I mean, the difference in body size between a male bonobo and a female bonobo is indistinguishable from the difference in body size between a male chimpanzee and a female chimpanzee. And so you might think that the ability of a male bonobo to bully a female bonobo is equivalent to the ability of a male chimpanzee to bully a female chimpanzee. Mm. And we know all too well that in chimpanzees, the males being some 20-30% heavier than the females, they are really appalling to the females. And in fact, every male, as he leaves adolescence and starts on his journey into the adult male hierarchy, he almost ritually picks on every different female in turn and beats her up to the point where she vocally submits to him, and then she will continue to do that for the rest of her life. Mm. So he has to bully every female mercilessly on his journey to becoming adult. And then you look at bonobos, and it's the reverse almost. So although the males are individually bigger in the same way than the females in bonobos, nevertheless, a male who risks the aggression of a female always risks being attacked by not only her, but her friends as well in response. And that's the big difference. In chimpanzees, sometimes females are present when a female is attacked and they don't do anything. In bonobos, almost always females are present when a female is attacked and they invariably jump in. And I think the best explanation for this difference is that there has been a consistent pattern over evolutionary time by which only in bonobos and not in chimpanzees have females traveled together as predictable allies, predictable supporters to each other. And we have an evolutionary explanation for this in terms of some slight differences in the environment in which they live. So, you know, we look at bonobos, we see nowadays that the way that explosive aggression in males is controlled is by alliances of females fighting back and very effectively chasing those males. So it seems likely that that is the way that the aggression of males has been selected to be reduced in the past because it just didn't work.
So what happens when the creatures enforcing this right and wrong in a group aren't the whole group of adults, but just the group of men? I mean, this is when we get to patriarchy, I guess.
Yes. You know, it's a kind of difficult area, this, because it's easy to say to oneself, well, it's the group as a whole that is benefiting when you get rid of one of these horrid males. But actually, the ones who really carry it out and the ones who in many ways benefit most directly are the other males. And here's the way that I tend to think about this if we sort of model it back in evolutionary time. You imagine, as language gets so sophisticated, that people are able to whisper together and form these decisions to get rid of even the most violent and dangerous and alarming man in the camp. What the males who carry that decision out have discovered is that they can get rid of anybody. If they can get rid of this tyrant, then they have control, the ability to control anybody in the group. And maybe that control is by just threatening them, saying, well, we killed that guy Joe, so what do you think we can do to you?
Yeah.
And essentially what has happened is that the group of beta males have become, as a group, the alpha, and they can exert their social power at will. Now, quite often, that social power will be used for things that benefit the group as a whole. You know, if somebody is creating chaos, then they can threaten him and ultimately dispose of him if he is threatening the lives of everybody in the group. But what is so startling is that if you look at small-scale society, hunters and gatherers, you know, who in many ways have just got delightful lives, all very charming, very little overt aggression, as I mentioned. But nevertheless, if a woman breaks some rule that is important to the men, then she is vulnerable not just to being chastised verbally, but ultimately she may be executed. And there are, you know, horrid accounts of a woman who happens to tread by accident even on a path that is supposedly just reserved for men because that's the way the men want it. Well, the men get together and say, she trod on our sacred path. What do we do with her? And they all say, kill her at once. And they go off and kill her. This seems to me to be a very important ultimate origin of one kind of patriarchy, yeah. Namely what we might call the social patriarchy or the communal patriarchy that's represented by the decisions of men as a group at the expense of those in the society who do things that they don't like.
We don't need to spend much more time on that. I would note that one of the things you've mentioned is you would like to spend more time, you've said, researching and writing about this evolution of patriarchy.
Yes. Because I think that many people tend to think that patriarchy is simply the consequence of individual men throwing their dominance about within the household, taking it out into society, and then men forming relationships based on their own personal experiences. In other words, sort of building up from the individual interactions of men and women. But it seems to me that the evolutionary perspective says something more haunting. And that is that for 200,000 or 300,000 years, humans have lived in societies in which it has paid men to form very tight coalitions with each other, which they use at the expense of others in the society. And I think this may well have had psychological impacts on the way in which men cooperate with each other compared to the way women cooperate with each other.
Mm. Let's talk more about this proactive form of aggression. How far back does the premeditated violence go back with humans, as far as we can tell?
It seems very likely that as long as we have been importantly hunting animals in the wild, we've had a very well-developed facility for proactive aggression. And most people would think that that goes back for the entire time of the genus Homo, which started 2 million years ago or so. We certainly have good evidence of spears being used by 400,000 years ago. But we also have from 800,000 years ago at a site in Israel, Gesher Benet Yaakov, very good evidence of people hunting and roasting meat. So although we can't know exactly how long people have been really hunting as opposed to scavenging for meat, it seems it's gone at least two or three times as long as Homo sapiens. In other words, well into earlier forms of Homo. And the reason that one thinks that once you are a hunter, then proactive aggression is likely to be well developed, is partly because in humans, when they hunt, they do in fact use proactive aggression a lot, yeah. In ambush, for instance, and partly because in other animals that are equivalent kinds of hunters, like lions and wolves and spotted hyenas, they use proactive aggression in their hunting, and they share with humans the feature that they use the killing techniques that they have evolved in hunting other species to their own species as well.
Yeah, killing strangers.
To kill strangers, exactly.
Yeah. So the societies that hunt tend to also be more inclined to go to war?
Yes, there's a little bit of evidence in that respect. I think it's probably a relationship that needs further examination. Mm. But it seems reasonable, partly because the boys, when they are learning these techniques of hunting and killing, they seem likely to be easily applied to hunting and killing other members of their own species. And clearly, the way in which the males are brought up is very important. You know, the cultures that are relatively militaristic are, of course, more likely to end up with adults who get involved in fighting. So it seems plausible that these correlations that have been found so far between hunting and warring across societies make some sense in terms of education.
Mm. Hunting, as you say, is a transferable skill. So that might make some sense to how we became connected to war, I guess.
Yes, and of course it's strange to think that hunting other people should be part of our ancestry, because for us growing up in our wonderfully civilized societies nowadays, that seems like a sort of science fiction fantasy almost. Mm. But if one looks at the descriptions of people living in small-scale societies where they are neighbored by other people of equivalent political, military, if you like, development, then what you find is that this pattern of hunting each other is, in a sense, the best description for a routine kind of behavior. Mm. And what I'm thinking of is that the pattern of war is not massed battles coming together and people enthusiastically hacking at each other. Instead, it is an exchange of raids. And those raids are like little hunting expeditions. Mm. So the raid might involve a small group of men, I mean, quite small, you know, five or six or so men, that sort of thing, going off for maybe 1, 2, 3, 4 days' journey to go off and attack somebody in a neighboring group. They don't normally know who they want to attack. They'll just find, you know, the first man who staggers out of a hut in the dawn light to have a pee, plonk some spears into him, and then run back again. I mean, it's an astonishing thing, but these sorts of interactions, they certainly weren't happening all the time. They happened when there was tension between two groups, but nevertheless, they happened. And they're really very much like just wanting to hunt, except you don't want to necessarily take the body.
Richard Wrangham, he's a professor of biological anthropology at Harvard University. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Goodness Paradox, The Strange Relationship Between Virtue and Violence in Human Evolution. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER is listener-supported public radio. And our most dependable support comes from our nearly 9,000 sustainers, people just like you who make ongoing monthly contributions. Starting at just $5 a month, you can become a sustainer too. Go to KUER.org, click on the donate button, and tell us how you'd like to contribute. Use your credit card or make it even easier with a direct withdrawal from your bank account. Join our growing community of sustainers today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Richard Wrangham. We're talking about his new book, The Goodness Paradox, The Strange Relationship Between Virtue and Violence in Human Evolution. I want to come back to something you were talking about earlier a bit, mentioning the work of Christopher Bohm, who wrote the book Moral Origins. This gets us to the question of morality, because another really important reason to explain how it is humans aren't so violent reactively is morality. Morality, you say, is vital. So there's this question here. Why is it that people are afraid of being criticized, for example? Because you say the sensitivity to criticism helps explain our evolutionary success. Explain how.
Yeah, I think this is a wonderful set of insights by Bohm, which come from realizing the potent significance of capital punishment. Because once you had capital punishment, then you had this terrific power in the hands of the men who controlled the punishment. And what it meant was that anybody who was a nonconformist from the point of view of doing something that the men didn't like was putting their lives in danger. So as a consequence, you got selection in favor, I think, Bohm is right here, of moral sensibilities that have a sort of tendency for a gut reaction not to do anything that might offend other people in the group. Mm. You know, the old days, you know, before this kind of thinking came in, then the costs of being seen to be a bit of a joker or rather rude or somewhat offensive or slightly selfish would seem to be relatively small. But if the cost is that you come to be seen as someone who is so detrimental that it would be just easier to get rid of you, mm-hmm. once we recognize that capital punishment is actually a very low cost to the aggressors. I mean, you lose an individual in the group, but the actual process of getting rid of someone is not risky. So once you realize that, then suddenly the costs and benefits of being seen to be a nonconformist change a lot, mm-hmm. and it becomes very, very dangerous. So I think that Bohm is right that our moral sensibilities evolved to protect us from being seen as somebody who wasn't in line with group interests. And, of course, the wonderful consequence, the incidental consequence of this nasty process is a very nice consequence, which is that everybody tends to work together to benefit the group, to advance group interests.
You mentioned in the book that this is difficult for us to keep in our minds the idea that we have these two parts of ourselves that seem so different. But you say we have to keep in mind a couple of things. First, that our evolutionary history, as you say, doesn't necessarily preordain us going forward. It's just a story, you say. It's not an account of the past. And it's not a recommendation to return to the past. That's one thing that's important. And when we're talking about capital punishment, and this is one of the things you're quite clear about, is just because humans used capital punishment to keep violence in check in the past doesn't at all, for you, at all make this an argument for capital punishment today. Say something about that, if you would.
The way in which capital punishment was practiced in the past was very different from its use by a state.
Yeah.
It was practiced by people who knew each other intimately. It was done with the agreement of the kin, the family members of the victim. And it was done with a particular purpose in mind, to get rid of someone who was not stoppable by any other means, because there wasn't any other means. There were no prisons. Right. There was no military. There was no state to intervene. I don't think it was particularly pleasant in those days. And, you know, I'm not sure I would recommend it in the past, even though it did, in fact, have these long-term good outcomes.
Yeah.
But I certainly don't recommend it nowadays. You know, capital punishment nowadays has appalling problems. Very often it makes mistakes. In other words, it kills people who later prove to be innocent. It's extremely costly. And the criminological data that I've seen indicate that it doesn't work to deter people.
Mm.
So I don't think there's any justification for it in a world in which we do have prisons. I think the main reason it happens nowadays is because of our old evolutionary emotions. It's revenge very often that we want to carry out, even at the expense of conducting it on the wrong individual. So, you know, we don't want to go back to our past in that way. But just to pick up on something else you said, you know, I think that the value of an evolutionary account is it gets us closer to understanding the realities of our psychology.
Right.
It means that we can escape this old duality of thinking either we're really, really good by nature or we're really, really horrid by nature, and that just leads to a sterile debate. But people often worry that if, in fact, it is the case that in our evolutionary past, individuals who were highly aggressive, in this case in the form of proactive aggression, were successful, then does that mean that we are doomed to proactive aggression wreaking its havoc in the future?
Yeah.
And I think the answer to that is no for, I mean, there are probably several reasons, but here's a couple. You know, one is that we know perfectly well that societies have existed in which for many decades they are not at war and there is a very great peace within the society. So that tells us that it is perfectly possible to escape these evolutionary tendencies. And then there's a logic to it too. And the logic is that proactive aggression is only carried out, whether it's an animal or a human, by individuals who think they can get away with it. And so as long as we construct a world in which individuals don't get away with abusing their power, then we can expect that their tendencies to use violence will be suppressed. And what that means is that we've got to be very careful about removing, sweeping away institutions that have been important in the past in coming to international agreements and treaties and anti-genocide institutions and so on, because just the fact that they have worked for a few decades does not mean they're not necessary. The evolutionary lesson to me is that in humans, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, as Lord Acton says. And it's absolutely vital that we bear this in mind, because in a world without awareness of it, or without the cultural institutions that keep men in particular from abusing their power, that's a world that is much more dangerous.
It brings up something you mentioned later in the book, something expressed by Katharine Hepburn's character in the movie The African Queen, that nature is what we are put on this world to rise above. This seems like something you believe in.
It sure is. You know, I mean, I love nature. You know, I love being with chimpanzees in the wild. I would hate to be a chimpanzee. Life is tough in the wild, and it was tough for our ancestors in the past. You know, they were often hungry. They were subject to horrible diseases. They were wounded and didn't have good medicine to help them. The dentistry was appalling. You know, I mean, the practical aspects are hideous, but the social aspects were pretty awful too.
Yeah.
You know, they were living in a social cage. The intensity of the claustrophobia within a small group was huge. You know, if somebody ostracized you, the social pain was just fantastic. If you got into fights with people, the consequences could be hideous. There were all sorts of ways in which the past was terrible. You know, slavery has been a almost ubiquitous feature of societies that were settled. There were so many bad things about the past. We should not look back to it and say, oh, if only we could go back and be as nature intended.
Yeah.
You know, nature never intended anything, of course. You know, it all just happened. But we are incredibly lucky to be living in the era that we do. We are so comfortable. We are so well off. We are so well looked after. We have such generally peaceful lives. We should just never forget our luck, because it is all too easy for us to lose the features that have given us such, you know, tremendous advantages now compared to being a wild animal.
Do you feel like, finally, Doctor, that we can, as you put it in the book, you know, cherish our rough past and still rise above it? Maybe you could say something about a story you tell later in the book. A few years ago, you went to Auschwitz, the former Nazi death camp. Maybe say something about what you saw there that told you about the good and the bad of human cooperation.
The context for this is that many of the reflections nowadays, thinking about what makes humans special, are addressing the question of how it is that humans are the ultra cooperators, so much better at cooperating in large groups with people we don't know in diverse ways than any other species. And I went to Auschwitz, and all around me I saw evidence of cooperation. There was cooperation among the guards themselves. There was cooperation between the prisoners and the guards. There's cooperation among the prisoners. You get taken in to see where people quietly go into the rooms where the Zyklon B was distributed and people were hideously gassed. It made me remember that the problem of cooperation is one that, from a practical point of view, is not a difficult problem nowadays at all. Because even under the most terrible circumstances, cooperation happens in its diverse ways. From a practical point of view, the real problem that humans have is how to master our competitive instincts that can lead to violence.
Richard Wrangham, his new book is The Goodness Paradox, The Strange Relationship Between Virtue and Violence in Human Evolution. He joined us from a studio on the campus of Harvard University, where he is a professor of biological anthropology. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.